Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Dr. Sajan Joel joins us for the first time. He's a friend of Anne and myself of long standing, but it's his first visit to Australia. Now, I'll introduce him briefly. He's the International Security Director of the Asia Pacific Foundation in London. He's a visiting lecturer in International History Department at the London School of Economics and senior advisor to the Combating Terrorism Working Group, which is associated with NATO and NATO-related organisations. And tonight, our speaker's going to talk on the topic, After the Fall of the Caliphate, How Terrorism Will Continue to Challenge. Dr. Goel, you're very welcome. Thank you.
Well, thank you again for your hospitality. It's a real pleasure to be here at the Sydney Institute. This is my first trip to Australia, so it's nice that I'm able to do it here. My speech is probably going to be about 20 minutes. It was going to be a little longer. I had some cricketing analogies, but after the debacle yesterday in Adelaide, I've cut out a lot. I'm going to talk this evening about the current global terrorism landscape and the existing and emerging challenges. As 2017 reaches a global close, there have been important developments in counterterrorism. Last month, the Iraqi Prime Minister Haider al-Abadi declared military victory over the so-called Islamic State in Iraq. Iraqi and Kurdish fighters, along with support from the Western coalition, have given their lives for more than 3 years since the so-called Islamic State declared its caliphate. And they ruled with an edict of brutality, misogyny, and fear. This has not been an easy battle. Effectively, there have been some 68 nations from around the world, including Australia, that formed a coalition to train, equip, and provide air support for the regional forces, mostly in Iraq, but also those Kurdish factions in Syria. It would be premature to write the so-called Islamic State's obituary just yet. They still occupy that presence in Syria. And through their affiliates, they are able to plot and plan attacks. They have a presence and a footprint in Libya, in Afghanistan, Pakistan, as well as in the southern Philippines. They have supporters across Europe, North America, including in Australasia. And it's also important to remember that they have killed many Muslims as well in their transnational attacks. At its height, the so-called Islamic State launched coordinated large-scale attacks in Paris, London, Brussels, to name but a few. Equally, they've also inspired lone actors to initiate small-scale attacks, but which have still caused enormous problems socially, economically, and politically. Here in Sydney, in this great city, it had to also endure terrorism at the Lind Cafe siege in 2014, almost 3 years ago, in fact. The attack may have not been sophisticated, and the plotter, Man Harold Moniz, may have had tenuous links with international terrorism. But his actions caught the attention of the so-called Islamic State, who heralded him as one of their own soldiers. And that's what they do. If somebody tries to take responsibility for an act of terrorism on behalf of this group, they will try and then utilize it for their propaganda. For this terrorist outfit, all news is good news. This oxygen of publicity is what feeds and nourishes their warped agenda. They not only need media attention, but they survive and depend on it. This is where terminology becomes so important. Now, you've heard this group being attributed with various names. ISIS, as in Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. The ISIL, Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant. Shortened sometimes is Islamic State. And then you also have the Arabic version, which is Al-Dawla Al-Islamiyya Fi Al-Iraq Wal-Sham, the acronym for that being Daesh. The term Daesh still accurately spells out the group's full name in Arabic, but it also carries a number of different connotations. Daesh is very close to the Arabic word of Dahez, which means one who sows discord. Daesh can also be understood as a play of words and an insult. Depending on the context, in Arabic slang, it can mean to trample down and crush. It can also mean a bigot who imposes views on others. The group doesn't like the name Daesh and does not endorse it because it doesn't spell out the critical Islamic state component that they want people to use. How we define this group is an important step in turning off its oxygen supply. This is, after all, about branding to some degree. If a product is labeled with an unappealing name, it attracts less interest. The same applies to terrorism. Unintentionally, when we say Islamic State or ISIS or ISIL, we are inadvertently endorsing the group's religious credentials. But the name Daesh stops that notion in its tracks. I've made this pitch since 2015 to anyone who will listen, and it's pleasing that it's gained some traction over the years. I want to point out that this is not about political correctness. It's about being effective. Is that we don't need to play into their hands and the game and the strategy they want. So for the remainder of my presentation, I'll be referring to them as Daesh. Because effectively, they are bigots who try and trample down on people. And that is what the slang means. Even though its physical landmass is contracting, Daesh still operates in the virtual world, unaffected, uninhibited. The group even has its own intelligence unit, known as the EMNI, which is based on Saddam Hussein's Ba'athist Mukarrabat, his own intelligence agency. This is a combination of internal police force and external operations branch, dedicated to plotting terrorism. Senior members of Saddam Hussein's inner circle that joined Daesh, not for ideological reasons, but to make money principally, brought their intelligence training with them and helped establish a terrorism group with the efficiency of an intelligence agency. And that is quite a scary notion. The EMNI was established before the caliphate was even declared. That highlights the priority that Daesh gave to it. It is currently, as we speak, proliferating online. The infrastructure which enables Daesh to conduct high-impact, low-sophisticated attacks continues. The EMNI lurk within the dark web and also using encrypted messaging in order to play a guiding hand in many of the plots that have unfolded in the West over the last few years. Daesh has its own magazine, which is available online, quite openly, quite freely, which is called Rumaya. It specifically promotes a tactic of terrorism called Just Terror, which is a double play on words. Just terror, as in religiously justified terrorism, and also just to do it terrorism. This is simple, cost-effective form of terrorism that involves several different elements, sometimes knives or vehicles. Often the two are combined. And then there's the third dynamic, which is now gaining ground, which is hostage taking. We've seen a plethora of attacks involving these methods. Vehicles have become lethal weapons designed to mow people down. Knives are used to kill, maim, and incapacitate people. And hostage taking is designed to lure the police to the scene of the crisis in order to kill them. We've seen vehicle attacks in London, Stockholm, Berlin, Nice, New York, and there's others. Knife attacks have been used on an even greater scale, so often that they don't always make the news. And Daesh's direct endorsement for hostage taking was actually first initiated here in Australia. Back in June of this year, Yaqub Khairi, a Somali-born Australian, killed a receptionist and held another person hostage at the Buckingham International Service Apartments in Brighton, which is a suburb of Melbourne. In a subsequent shootout with the police, who were lured to the scene, Khairi was killed and three Australian officers were wounded. Daesh claimed responsibility through its own self-styled news agency, Amaq. Daesh has made a very important point of wanting to kill people in law enforcement and in the military. Because in their very twisted logic, if the people that are tasked in protecting society are made to feel insecure and weak about their own safety, then in turn, society becomes insecure and weak. There have been multiple attacks against the police and against the military globally. Some attacks have resulted in the police and armed forces losing their lives. And sadly, we will probably see more of those incidents as we go into 2018. The principal purpose of this goal is to kill as many people as possible whilst dying in a hail of bullets. This is a tactic called Ingamas. You may have not heard of it, but it is becoming now the main style of terrorism that this group is promoting. Ingamas means plunging into. The medieval scholar Ibn Taymiyyah wrote a treatise back during the Mongol invasion, which saw the fall of the Abbasid Caliphate. What Daesh has done is that they have reinterpreted that for the modern age, specifically the tactic. Ingamas is different to a suicide bomber who detonates his device and dies immediately. An Ingamasi endures till they are shot dead or apprehended, if possible. So the aim is to keep killing until that person is physically no longer able to. Even though there has been much focus on Daesh's activity stemming from Syria and Iraq, there also needs to be attention to the ungoverned spaces in North Africa, especially Libya, where Daesh also has a presence. And through transportation links with the European Mediterranean countries, it is possible for them to send their personnel into the European Union. This will be an ongoing concern as we move ahead. Like with the 2015 Paris marauding attacks, terrorists have demonstrated their ability to cross international borders, establish compartmentalized cells, carry out the reconnaissance of targets, and execute mass casualty attacks. Additionally, modern technology increases the potential impact of terrorists employing conventional as well as unconventional means. Disturbingly, Daesh are also grooming online boys and girls in the West, directing them to carry out terrorism. What is particularly worrying about this is that a lot of these young boys and girls are effectively children. Some of them are under the age of 16. Last year, in the build-up to Christmas, an Iraqi boy who was living in Germany at age 14 had been recruited online to put together two explosive devices and leave them at a Christmas marketplace in Ludwigshafen in Germany. Fortunately, the devices did not detonate, and he was dealt with by the authorities. But he was only 14 years old and given guidance to put together an explosive device. Daesh has used young boys to shoot Iraqi and Syrian prisoners in their propaganda videos, very gruesome, horrific videos. And they are now trying to actively recruit child soldiers in the West. They've also been developing mobile phone apps that on the surface look very innocent. They look like games for children to play. But in fact, there are subtle hidden agendas in those game apps where they are actually training children to carry out attacks on well-established locations and buildings like the Eiffel Tower or Big Ben or the Statue of Liberty. This subtle strategy is designed to lure children into eventually plotting an act of terrorism. This challenge cannot be ignored. We should equally not forget about the other terrorist group that you may remember, Al-Qaeda. They are showing signs of quietly rebuilding and allowing Daesh to take the heat from the international community whilst they try to evade the radar of the global commitment against terrorism and quietly replenish their ranks. In an echo of the past, the Egyptian leader of Al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri, has been grooming bin Laden's son, Osama bin Laden's son, Hamza, as well as entrusting Al-Qaeda's renewal to some of his Egyptian deputies, such as Saif al-Adl. Both Hamza bin Laden and Saif al-Adl actually spent time in Iran in the aftermath of 9/11. It still remains very unclear as to what the relationship between Al-Qaeda and the Iranian regime is. But it appears to be, it does not necessarily appear, actually, to be as antagonistic as the Al-Qaeda propaganda suggests. We know that Al-Qaeda has openly talked about its hatred towards Shia Muslims. Yet why were they given sanctuary in Iran? The Bin Laden papers found in his compound in Abbottabad, Pakistan, show that Bin Laden didn't want any of his followers to attack Iran because they needed the country for logistical reasons. The current heir to the terrorist throne, Hamza Bin Laden, is also married to the current head of Al-Qaeda, Ayman al-Zawahiri's daughter, and he has two children. So al-Zawahiri has effectively ensured that he can keep hold of the Bin Laden legacy firmly attached to his own doctrine through a strategic marriage alliance, whilst cultivating the Bin Laden name. Back in 2015, Zawahiri gave a speech in which he described Hamza Bin Laden as the son of the Lion of Jihad. Hamza Bin Laden's own speeches have revived the image and words of his father when he said, quote, "We will continue to target you. We will continue to strike and target your country at home and abroad." Al-Zawahiri publicly calls for attacks in the West, yet privately his instructions appear different. In a May 2015 interview with Al Jazeera, the head of what was once an Al-Qaeda affiliate in Syria, Muhammad al-Ghulani, who leads now the group Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, actually revealed that Ayman al-Zawahiri told him not to use Syria as a launch pad to target the West, but instead focus on the Assad regime. And there is a very strategic, deliberate reason for this. The aim is that if Al-Qaeda starts targeting the West right now, when they are not fully established again, the West will come down on them hard, and they're not in a position to survive that. So it's best that they quietly reestablish themselves and develop safe havens. The other thing is that since the Arab Spring, there's been limited evidence of Al-Qaeda directing or planning attacks on Western soil. There have been some exceptions. There was a nebulous plot by the so-called Khorasan group based in Idlib, Syria, in 2014, which was designed to attack Western aviation. But that was a drawing board plot. It never got off the immediate stage of planning. The Kouachi brothers, Sherif and Said, that carried out the shootings at the Charlie Hebdo offices in Paris back in 2015, they claimed the attack on behalf of Al-Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula. Yet they had not had contact with that group since 2011. So there was a gap of some 4 years. Al-Qaeda is trying to reconstruct itself as a radical social movement, which is based on several principles. Material. They need money and capital. And they can't do that if they are constantly getting hemmed in and attacked by drone strikes or ground operations. They need to also focus on the morale, creating solidarity and support for its goals. They need human capital. In order to carry out terrorism, they need volunteers and they need leadership to recruit. Organization. The group also needs to develop its networks and also establish a more effective cell structure, similar to what it once had. Lastly, cultural. The group needs to reevaluate its own doctrine and its ideology in order to frame it into the current context. They are developing as we speak, and the focus still remains the local, the near enemy, as in the Assad regime or the al-Sisi government in Egypt. Its long-term goal, though, will be to attack the West. But for the time being, al-Zawahiri and Hamza bin Laden want to focus on establishing safe bases where it can operate and function. The priority will be to carry out terrorist attacks within its current geographical proximity in places like Afghanistan and against Western interests in neighboring Pakistan. They will also support attacks against the regimes that they have identified as despotic. With Al-Qaeda's rise inside sanctuaries in Pakistan, we must not forget that the problems still exist in neighboring Afghanistan. The Taliban insurgency has gained strength since the withdrawal of international troops from combat operations at the end of 2014. And the Taliban are stronger now than at any point since 2001. Heavy fighting has continued across Afghanistan, from Kunduz in the north to Helmand province bordering Pakistan in the south. The Taliban has launched large-scale attacks against the Afghan government with suicide bombers, guerrilla fighter attacks, as well as assassinations. Additionally, with continued support from all the different factions of the Taliban, such as the Quetta Shura Taliban or the Haqqani Network, Al-Qaeda will use its position within Pakistan to plot and plan future attacks against NATO member nations, as well as targeting the Resolute Support Mission, RSM, in Afghanistan. Files recovered from Osama bin Laden's abortaboard compound in Pakistan highlight the degree to which Al-Qaeda's men cooperate with factions such as the Haqqani Network. Doesn't get much attention, but the Haqqani Network is not just a Taliban faction. It is not just a terrorist group. It is also a criminal enterprise. 50% of the footage shot in Al-Qaeda's propaganda operations, which are broadcast through its own self-styled As-Sahab media outlet, are located within the Haqqani Network territory inside Pakistan. 50%. The Haqqani Network is also the most sophisticated and financially diversified terrorist group in the world, with interests in Afghanistan, Pakistan, and also within Gulf Arab states. In addition to raising funds from ideologically like-minded donors, the Haqqanis have front companies which are involved in import-export, transport, real estate, car dealerships, construction, even hostage-taking, narcotics, and taxation through protection money. They are very diversified, and very little has been done to dismantle their network since 2001. Positively, NATO has decided to increase troop levels for Afghanistan in 2018. It's currently around 13,000 for the NATO troops in the assist and train and advise mission. It's expected to rise to about 16,000. Australia's defense forces play a critical role in global security and stability, and it's very pleasing that Australia intends to increase its troop personnel to 300 in Afghanistan. That will be so critical to the country's peace and stability. It is essential to strengthen the capabilities and the capacities of the Afghan National Security Forces to fight the Quetta Shura Taliban and the Haqqani Network, and to fight the different terrorist groups in Afghanistan, including the Daesh affiliate, Wilayat Khorasan. NATO also needs to keep working with the Afghan Special Operations Forces and help the country to develop their own air forces in order to preserve the security of Afghanistan. If Afghanistan is abandoned or ignored, the same nefarious forces that turned the country into a cesspool for terrorism in the 1990s will return, if they're not there already. History has a disturbing way of repeating itself, and terrorist groups will once again feel that they can use Afghanistan as a staging ground to plot and plan terrorist attacks globally. Afghanistan is not Iraq or Libya. It often gets lumped into the same discussion that we talk about in terms of Western involvement. The people in Afghanistan need international support. They depend on it. We must not abandon them again. That means some countries having to share the heavy lift once again. But what I would argue is that it's better to bear that brunt now rather than in the aftermath of a terrorist attack where dozens of people may have been killed from a plot that was originated in Afghanistan. Some concluding thoughts. As Daesh capitulates, there will be blowback from the foreign terrorist fighters that had gone to join them. Some will be tossed out to carry out attacks in their home countries. Some are simply biding their time, waiting for the opportunity to return to their countries of origin, including potentially Australia. But they don't necessarily want to do it now because they know the focus of them coming back is quite intense. So they will wait for that focus to die down. The physical contraction of Daesh's territory will continue, but the virtual caliphate is going to grow, expand, and proliferate. There is no restrictions on that. There will be a continuation of those just terror attacks. The Emni will continue to recruit and direct plots. And there is often a network. It may not necessarily be a physical network, but there is a virtual network involved through the dark web, through encrypted messaging. There will be more youth terrorists under the age of 16, groomed by Daesh. Not every attack can be thwarted, and not every potential individual can be dissuaded from partaking in terrorism. So we have to understand that for law enforcement, whether it's in the UK or in Australia, is that those in the police have a very difficult job. But I would argue they're doing their level best in keeping our society safe. And sometimes we should give them more credit than they actually get. Not every attack can be thwarted, but we must brace ourselves for those potential plots that may occur. Al-Qaeda is slowly growing in strength, and it's important not to ignore them, because in the long term, they will want to try and carry out attacks against our societies again. Lastly, we cannot afford to abandon Afghanistan, as it will be detrimental to our own safety and to our own security. Now, with that in mind, I will conclude and gladly take any questions that you have. Thank you for your patience.
Dr. Gill, thanks very much for your address here tonight. So we'll come to questions and discussion and finish no later than the top of the hour.
Questions about the ashes, though.
Well, yeah, we probably should ban them, yeah, that's okay. You've spoken about the build-up of Al-Qaeda, you've spoken about the foreign fighters and said some may be slow coming home, but they may come home when the attention fades a bit. But what about that? You have a lot of contact with police in Europe and North America. In Australia, we've spoken a bit about the de-radicalisation process. I think we've put a lot of money in it. I read a report recently that was virtually no success, that it's very hard to find anyone in the prison system who has been de-radicalised, whereas it's quite easy to find people in the prison system who have been radicalised there. So the assessment from the Northern Hemisphere is the general view that de-radicalisation can work, or is it regarded as sort of a gesture that doesn't really mean much?
It's probably been one of the biggest challenges about de-radicalisation, that how do you stop somebody who has got views that are intolerant to the society that they live in, where their intention is to kill, where they have real hatred inside them. It is a challenge, and it is one that no one has an answer to. And the problem also is that it is hard to lump who gets radicalized into one category. You could have people that come from very deprived backgrounds. Socioeconomically, it's not great. They've suffered abuse from their family members. They left home early. They're not educated. On the other side, you can have very well-educated people, good jobs, good opportunities. They've got families, and yet they will also give that up. There is a doctrine that seems to be what I would call junk food ideology, which appeals to certain people. And I would say that you cannot stop the radicalization of everybody. You can try and slow it down. But if the propaganda exists, if the media halo that groups like Daesh continue to use that infects the minds of young impressionable people, de-radicalization will continue to face challenges. And I think all one can do is more slow it down, but not eliminate it.
Right, so John?
Dr. Goel, thank you very much. I find it very interesting that you give some emphasis to the younger people. There's an incident in Sydney that post the Lynch siege, of course, in which a 15-year-old lad up in Parramatta murdered a civil employee at the police station headquarters in Parramatta. And fortunately, there was a very brave special constable who took him out before he could do any further damage. But it seems that most of the incidents that we've experienced in Australia along those lines are from the younger generation of people between 15 and early 20s. It's a very difficult thing. How do we counter that sort of thing? This young man came from a family that had no history of any zealotry in their religious faith or anything like that. He was doing very well at the local high school. He was well liked by all of his fellow students. And suddenly he snapped into this mode of taking a gun and killing an innocent civilian employee of the local police department in a one-off afternoon foray.
It's interesting. He would fit into this category that's called a revert. Somebody who actually seemed to have integrated been a good example for society. And we've seen cases like that in Europe too. And then suddenly something clicks in their head and they buy into that warped ideology. And they not only embrace it, they then want to actively take part in some form of terrorism. Not necessarily a complicated one, but one where they think there's an opportunity. The fact is that the terrorist groups understand new media technology better than we do. And there's a kind of perverse irony here, is that they want to use modern technology to replicate medieval brutality. And they have understood it better than we have in order to try and stop it. And as long as the dark web exists, the wild west of the internet, as long as encrypted messaging is there, the terrorists throw out a wide net and they hope to catch in a few young, impressionable people. And I'm afraid it's just very difficult to stop it, especially in a democracy, in a Western society where there is freedom of expression, where the internet is not cut off or restricted. These people will use that and exploit it. And it is one where we need to have a discussion as to how does one stop people from misusing it. We're not talking about Facebook or Twitter or YouTube. We're talking about a much more darker process on the internet where the youth know how to go to and access. And I think it's just going to be more and more harder to stop this, I'm afraid.
Thank you for your analysis. Could you mention something about the contacts and the links between these terrorist groups and some sovereign states, such as Qatar and North Korea?
So, it's an interesting question that some countries have been accused of not doing enough to deal with these terrorist groups, and on the contrary, have actually allowed them to operate and flourish. Qatar has been accused of being somewhat blind to the activities of the Al-Qaeda affiliate, Jabhat Fateh al-Sham. We know that also there are people within certain governments in the Arab Gulf states, as well as in Pakistan, that have ideological sympathies for these groups. President Erdogan of Turkey also has been accused, rightly or wrongly, of allowing a lot of these fighters to travel through Turkey in order to harm the Kurdish factions in Syria, and also because of his own personal animosity at one time to the Assad regime. And this is where one of the problems is that if states do not do enough to clamp down on these groups, they will take ruthless advantage of the situation. So that is something that one has to have a discussion also at a governmental level. I think one is always, at a governmental level, is worried that somehow if you don't approach this subject, if you do approach it, you'll offend a specific country. But I think we've gone past the point of offending them when lives are at stake.
Dr. Gold, thank you very much for your presentation. I guess I wanted to ask you about this other phenomenon of these young radicalized people being torn between two cultures. I read a very interesting comparison between Leicester, which is considered a model multicultural city in Britain, and Bradford, and the motivating factor was that people in Leicester were settled migrant communities. They didn't live a kind of transnational life. The young men in Leicester didn't seek their spouses back from their town or village in South Asia, whereas in cities like Bradford they did. So you've got young people who are torn between different cultures, and it seems that that transnational identity makes them more susceptible to these radicalized messages. I'd be interested in your take on that.
So it's interesting. Leicester tends to, that you mentioned in the East Midlands, tends to have a very large Indian diaspora. So they are predominantly from India, the Hindus. The religious radical ideology doesn't impact on them as, say, what you also mentioned about Bradford, where you have people who are of Pakistani heritage, some of whom had at one time been radicalized by the Al-Qaeda doctrine, then became radicalized by the Daesh doctrine. What is a problem is that these young people that get radicalized by groups like Al-Qaeda and Daesh, they're looking for identity and for a purpose. And sometimes when states don't try and create that identity, the very murky hand of the recruiter, at one time physical, now virtual, will fill that gap, give simple, easy answers to their questions. And they will encourage them to take up arms, whether it's a knife or even drive a vehicle to kill people. They will encourage them at one time when the caliphate of Daesh was growing to travel abroad. And the thing is, none of these young people look at the fine print of what that actually means. A lot of people that went to join Daesh didn't actually realize what they were going to get until they got there. And many of them wanted to leave, but by then it was too late. And I think one of the most important weapons against these groups is to point out as to how many Muslims they've actually killed. The mass graves that they've uncovered in Syria and Iraq have been of Muslim women and children. This group is a death cult, and they kill everybody. And I think if people are confused about their identity, they need to also understand that choosing the path of terrorism is not going to fix and solve any concerns or problems they have. It's only going to make it worse.
Thank you. Thank you very much for the talk. I just, last answer you used the word death cult. Our previous Prime Minister was pilloried for using those terminology. I'm actually asking about Burma and Rohingya and whether that is a government seeing itself under siege from Daesh or, in your opinion, or is it just a genocide?
It's a difficult question about the Rohingya issue. There is definitely a fact that these people have been persecuted, not just in the last year or two. It has been there an issue that has been bubbling beneath the surface for several years. More does need to be done to help alleviate the problem. What doesn't get mentioned is that there are militant groups in the Rakhine province, where the Rohingya are based in Myanmar, that have actually aligned themselves ideologically with Daesh, that carried out attacks against the Burmese forces and actually exploited the situation in order to increase their recruitment size. So that issue hasn't got as much attention as it needs to, but certainly a lot more needs to be done to address the humanitarian crisis of the Rohingyas, because the people that have had to flee their homes, they've got no connection to terrorism. They are not radicalized. And it is unfortunate and deeply unfair that they have had to be caught in this middle between a militant group and the military in Myanmar. And just to address that point about describing Daesh as a death cult, I don't think there's another way of describing them. When they embrace death, as much as you or I or anyone else here cherishes life, it puts into perspective what their agenda is. They want to kill, and they are ready to be killed. And we need to separate them from the religion of Islam, because they are trying to attach themselves to it. But they are not representative of their faith. They are a cult, and they are a cult that very much cherishes death. So I think that there is no better term for that.
Also, thank you very much for your comments. You spoke towards the end about Afghanistan, and you said the need to help Afghanistan. We and other countries have put a lot of money and resources and people into Afghanistan, and yet the governments we've been able to produce all seem to be corrupt. They don't seem to be helping the average people, and they're not supported. And history shows us that whenever you have that, you will end up with that government becoming despotic and eventually getting overthrown. And the other thing about Afghanistan is, I rather gather from history, although you'd be better at that than me, that they've always had this thing about fighting. And if they didn't have someone external to fight, they'd fight with each other. The villagers, it's just something in their DNA.
Okay.
Is that unfair?
It's a really important and interesting observation that you make. Afghanistan actually had a lot of peace and stability prior to the Soviet occupation. It was a place that people said had natural beauty. It had stability. They were united under the Pashtun king until he was overthrown. and it created divisions. Then when the West decided to sponsor the Arab-Afghan Mujahideen, pouring billions of dollars into a conflict, that created massive repercussions. And this is also then part of the other problem, is that the West has never ever had a consistent long-term strategy for Afghanistan. Once the Soviets were defeated in Afghanistan, it was abandoned, and all hell broke loose, which gave rise to the Taliban. It took 9/11 to get the West back in Afghanistan to focus on the situation. Even the bombings of the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania did not motivate the West. It required 9/11, such a horrific incident. And then up to the start of 2003, the Taliban were on the verge of being decimated. And it's one of those key moments in history that often get forgotten and neglected, is that we'd almost won in Afghanistan. Then, for reasons, rightly or wrongly, the Bush administration decided to start that war in Iraq. And resources were deviated and moved to Iraq. And I think that was a key turning point that allowed the Taliban to replenish and regrow. Following from the Bush administration, the Obama administration then decides to do a withdrawal of troops and announces it in advance, giving the Taliban a timeline. There has to be consistency. If there isn't consistency in Afghanistan, we will continue to have problems, and you'll continue to have militias and corrupt people exploiting the situation. And I know it's difficult sometimes because governments change, strategies change. But if we could just have 5 years of consistency for Afghanistan, I honestly believe things could change. But we haven't had that in the last 40 years. So unless things change, we will continue to have these problems.
Thank you for your talk. You mentioned just in passing, really, that it's, especially around the flow of information, control of the internet, it's harder for democratic countries to come to grips with this. Do non-democratic countries do better than us in responding to terrorism generally? Also, you mentioned the question about identity and the way in which sometimes in the West we're not very good at presenting a vision of identity for young people to adopt. Again, I mean, do strong nationalistic countries or countries with a strong sense of themselves, China, Russia, perhaps Turkey, do they do a better job than democratic countries?
So, I think countries that are able to have more filters, that doesn't necessarily mean that on filters for the internet, that doesn't mean that they've been able to actually reduce the threat. Because, again, people that are radicalized and they are knowledgeable about the internet know how to bypass and find ways of accessing information, such as, say, the Uyghurs in China, in Xinjiang province. Many of them were able to access the radical propaganda, despite the restrictions there, and were joined either Daesh or they joined Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, mostly Jabhat Fateh al-Sham, in fact. The thing about identity is also that countries with a strong process of identifying your nationality, who you are, and where you belong, I would say it is better to have something that is clearer as opposed to something that is more ambiguous and laissez-faire. That doesn't mean that someone has to have that rammed down their throat. But if people can grow up feeling that this is their nationality and they can be part of it, it is better than as opposed to not having anything at all. I think that worries me a lot. So it's not that countries that are less democratic have it easier. They don't necessarily. But I think we can do more to maybe have a more clear identity for people so they don't have the excuse then that radicals exploited them and gave them an answer. We can also perhaps do more to stop them from accessing the dark web if there is a way of doing it. Because I think that is the discussion that really does need to be had, is that are there methods and processes to do that?
Thank you. Just drawing on that from that point, if we were to eradicate the caliphate, do you believe that we could assimilate these radicalized individuals back into society? And if so, how?
I think there are some people that are so ideologically gone, far gone mentally, that they are dangerous. Those that went and left our respective countries, like the UK or Australia, to join Daesh, a lot of them have actually expressed a desire to come back. I know from the UK example, I'm not sure about Australia, but the UK has a strict policy of not letting them back because they are potentially dangerous. And even though they may have said that they regret going, no one knows what their true intention and their agenda is. And one doesn't know whether they will try and recruit people as well. It is a difficult issue because one doesn't want to strip somebody of their citizenship. But if one lets them back, you're talking about resources having to be put in at a governmental level to monitor them. Resources that may need to be utilized elsewhere. So I don't think people that are already radicalized can afford to necessarily take them back. Those that are arrested within our countries, it depends on, I would say, the age. If they were really young, then you could argue that they were more easily exploitable and you can try and stop them from being radicalized. But those that go beyond a certain age, they know what they're doing and they knew exactly how they were doing it. There was one interesting example a few years ago of a British national who I think was 15 years old who was recruiting someone online in Australia to carry out an attack on Anzac Day. This was a 15-year-old that used the encrypted messaging. And yet, he was the recruiter of someone who was older to him. So there's a very strange dynamic at play here. That do we feel sorry for that 15-year-old because he came from a broken home, he had partial blindness, he had suffered violence from his family? Or do we feel that he actually deserves to be given the full punishment of the law? It's difficult for such a young person. It's a moral dilemma. I don't necessarily know the answer, but I don't think we can afford to take people back. I think that is way too dangerous.
Ben, that's a very important topic. You mentioned the number of attacks on fellow Muslims. For instance, when a mosque, for instance, is attacked, the ISIS can only be slaughtering fellow Muslims. Now, is this a factional conflict, you know, Shia versus Sunni, or what do we make of that?
So attacks on mosque, are they all Shiite versus Sunni, or is there something else there as well?
That is an element. The attacks on Shia mosques has been quite rampant in places like Pakistan or in Iraq. But if you look at the most recent example in the North Sinai in Egypt, that was actually a Sunni mosque. They were Sufi Muslims who have a less orthodox interpretation of Islam, but they are Sufi Muslims. And yet they were targeted in the most horrific way possible whilst praying, bombs exploding inside the mosque. And as they flee, they're also then shot as they're trying to escape. And I think something like over 230 people were killed, more than the Bali attack in 2002. It doesn't get much attention, and in many ways, news moves on. But they have killed a lot of Sunni Muslims. A lot of the mass graves that they found in Iraq and Syria have been mass graves of Sunni Muslims. And I think that is where I think the Western media could have done more to highlight just how many Muslims are being killed, that this is beyond just a sectarian communal issue.
Thank you, Dr. Gall.
Gotta be brief.
Very brief, yes. I want to get to a philosophical side of this, and whether it's philosophy or just now real politics. But is this all this accumulation of the Sykes-Picot, the partition of India, the Indian mutiny, the Iran officers starting ISIS, and a whole lot of other things, and it's just a welling up and better education? And if it's that, can we fight it from that side of it, or do we just go on killing them? Is there another way?
So the terrorist groups will always cite history as a motivation, as a way of justifying attacks. You mentioned the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which effectively was the agreement between Britain and France, which led to the dismantlement of the Ottoman Caliphate. But people forget that the Ottoman Caliphate, towards its end, was actually quite secular. It wasn't very religious. They will always look at history to justify the violence. But I would say that the biggest problem was the Soviet occupation of Afghanistan. where you had all these radical extremists from around the world that effectively got lumped together, and they met and converged together. And that created that bond and that unity that had not existed before. And that is the starting point, in my opinion, of where the real problems actually began. And that is why, again, I was talking about Afghanistan, is that these people were brought together, they came and found commonality, they created terrorism. And wherever there are places of insecurity, wherever there's a vacuum, you will find terrorists trying to fill that. It was Afghanistan at one point, then it was Iraq, now we're talking about Libya. They will find these opportunities, but they will always try and use history to justify their violence.
What's the probability of them getting hold of nuclear weapons?
So, there has always been a desire for transnational terrorist groups to carry out CBRN attack, chemical, biological, radiological, or nuclear. There was an Al-Qaeda plot back in the aftermath of 9/11 in the UK where individuals were trying to carry out a radiological dispersal device attack. It was disrupted by the authorities. The attack may have not killed many people, but the psychological damage of a dirty bomb exploding and the economic damage it would have created was significant. There were videos in which were discovered in the aftermath of 9/11 where they were experimenting on dogs using toxins. The nuclear goal is there. Terrorists want to carry out these mass casualty spectacular attacks. It very much feeds into their propaganda. The only country where there is that potential of them getting hold of something is Pakistan. There is a lot of instability there. And the country, unfortunately, is showing signs of getting even more radicalized. And the military, one doesn't really know where they stand. Some have ideological sympathies with terrorists. Oh, I know it's what worries the Americans a lot. So I think if there is the potential of that ever happening, of terrorists getting hold of nukes, it's potentially Pakistan.
As difficult a question as this might be to answer, if you could project forward, say, 10 years, what situation do you think we might be in? And assuming you could imagine a good outcome in the future, what would that be?
So, interesting. I think I see the problem, just to build on my previous answer, I see the problems in Pakistan getting worse. And I see the situation there continuing to, it's kind of a gradual spiral out of control. And then how do we deal with it? Because what happens in Pakistan has a knock-on effect in neighboring Afghanistan. And it impacts on that country as well. So I see that potentially getting worse. What worries me about Iraq is that the awakening that took place, which defeated Al-Qaeda in Iraq, all the positive work that was put in was destroyed when the previous Iraqi government started bringing in sectarian politics and alienated the Sunni Muslims. Iran is playing a very active role in Iraq, and they want to use that to their strategic advantage. That could mean, again, that Sunni Muslims may feel disenfranchised. And that, again, could mean that you could have a successor group to Daesh that may set up a route there. So that's what worries me, is if it's not resolved. And Libya. There are huge ungoverned spaces there that no one is necessarily paying attention to. So I think that is a potential problem. I don't know about successes. I think the threat keeps evolving. And we have very capable people in counterterrorism and law enforcement. I know, having interacted in a professional capacity with those in Australia, how well they do in keeping this country safe and how many plots they've disrupted. So I think one doesn't know exactly what success will mean in the future, because if one threat is dealt with, another one takes place. We thought Al-Qaeda was the most dangerous group after 9/11, and yet Daesh totally eclipsed them in terms of brutality. What could potentially happen next? I think I always am reminded by what the 9/11 Commission report said, that the biggest failure was not intelligence, it was lack of imagination. And we don't have the warped imagination that they have.
We've got room possibly for two very brief contributions. There's one here.
Dr. Gould, do you think there'd be any chance of a grand Muslim leader taking some sort of stand and saying that the Muslims, ISIS and so on, should be thoroughly ashamed in the name of Allah and change this doing things in the name of Allah, which is not quite correct, really, amongst most Muslims, I'd say.
I think there are many Muslims in the Islamic world that have those views. The problem is that there is a lack of democracy and transparency that does not give them that ability to articulate their views. We should remember that the Arab Spring was originally, the purpose was to get rid of corruption. When you had that man, Mohamed Bouazizi, in Tunisia, who set himself alight. He didn't carry out a terrorist attack. He didn't blow anybody up. He was so depressed and fed up of the corruption that he just hurt himself. And that is what triggered the Arab Spring, which was meant as a movement of hope to actually give people more transparent, more governance, more democracy, more freedom of expression. And that has just dwindled over time. There's not been any positives that I would say have come out of the Arab Spring. It has created more chaos. And in many ways, everything has gone back to the status quo, if not worse than before. So I think there are people, but the problem is they just don't have the opportunity to get an airing. And one needs to be able to find them and afford that opportunity. But there are many Muslims that would love to be able to say what you're saying.
Just a question. Terrorist groups thrive on instilling fear and harm. And I'd be interested to hear your view on the role of the media in not giving oxygen in the way that they report on incidents and fomenting fear.
So this is one of the issues that I was mentioning earlier about the oxygen of publicity. They know that when they carry out an attack, it gets attention and it gets broadcast. The only way you can stop it is to have a complete blackout. But that means getting every single media organization, both TV, internet, and written, to agree to that globally. I just never see that happening. In France, they stop certain things from being reported during a live event. But that's one country. It can still be seen outside. I remember during the Mumbai siege attacks, all the media had their cameras everywhere. And the handlers of the terrorist cell in Pakistan were navigating the terrorists by looking at the media to see how they were operating. So the media ended up unintentionally serving the eyes and ears of the terrorists. And that is, I think, a issue. And it's a very important issue, is that how does one turn off their media halo? Everybody wants to get there first with the media. That's also the problem, is that they want to be the first to report it. And I understand. They have their own jobs to do. But I think it's a battle that we may not be able to win. Because, going back to my very original point to your question, you need everyone to cooperate. And globally, that's impossible.
Finally, and very briefly, the Australian role. As you know, we have the Australian Federal Police, various state police, and territory police. Do you see much of them as you move around to these various meetings? I mean, are they linked into North America and Europe, the way our military is?
So Australia is one of the critical members of what's known as the Five Eyes community, which includes the US, UK, Canada, and New Zealand. And Australia is an essential part of that in terms of assistance, of cooperation, and has helped internationally, wherever the situation has required, both from a counterterrorism perspective, but also from a military operational point of view. And I don't think there can be a greater ally in this part of the world than Australia, that has not only put itself forward when required, but has also taken huge sacrifices in terms of people that have been killed in fighting against terrorism. And I know, having had professional relationship with the people in law enforcement here and also the military, just how capable they are. They are really some of the best in the world. And I think you can be very proud of them, and you can also feel safe that they're doing everything they can to keep you safe.
Many thanks. I'll just... It's that time of the year when everyone's very busy, so I'll be very brief. Look, it's been terrific to have Dr. Sajjan Goel here to talk about his experiences in this crucially important area of the caliphate and related matters to terrorism. He brings special skills as someone who can teach at the LSE, but also talk to police forces and military forces around the world. So in other words, an academically well-qualified man with a very practical an empirical mind, and we've seen that here today with historical analysis but linked into practical realities and possible tentative solutions. So we'd love to have you back sometime in the future, but tonight, well done and good luck.
Thank you.
Pleasure.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.